Who knows what topological space is? What topology is about?
Well, they nobody. Have an idea.
Oh, maybe some people heard about it. But, you know, the easiest way to explain what topology is about, just something like that. You're just saying topology is about, say, geometrical properties or things which do not change with continuous transformation. So, say, topologically speaking, this bottle and this thing are the same as just stable, right? Because I can, you know, make it flat. So this curvature does what does matter when I glue thing and when I cut them. Say if I have nothing like this. So here, for example, I have a hole, right? And that topologically different thing. So that's what the topology say is one rich area and very specific topology. Think about knot theory. How we do with knots and stuff like that, right? So we don't care about particular shape in usual sense of the word, right? But we care about things which don't change with continuous transformation. So it's kind of elastic geometry. And then I say things like that, right? You see that this notion of continuous transformation, which of course for mathematical purposes needs to be strictly defined and so far, it still comes as a kind of basic notion what this field is about, right? And but that structuralist thinking had took that approach that, okay, that there are all these transformations, but there is something invariant, which is of course important. Right now I say, let's think what kind of properties don't change with continuous transformation, right? Like to have a hole or not to have a hole, things like that, right? And then try to describe those invariant properties in kind of direct way. That's what they call it structure, okay? So we have, say, all this thing and all that thing are different instances of the same structure. And what is really structure, that we just making clear in this structural way. Or think about projective geometry. Again, if I am trying to explain what it's about, and even if I refer to history, how it emerged, I would talk about projective transformation, how you project things one to another, how you, I don't know, project a building onto a plane and things like that. But again, in that the structural thinking is that we should somehow capture the invariant. And that would be called structure, right? And how it transforms is, in a sense, it's a secondary issue, right? And in that sense, category theoretic thinking, just say, look, transformations are basic. In a sense, the kind of radical categorical approach would be just saying, we don't really need this classical notion of structure, we just need to understand how transformation works. Right? And important also point, because when I say there is invariant properties, invariant structure, then actually what I mean by transformation and what I should mean is reversible transformation. Because if transformation is not reversible, so isomorphism, right? So it's if it's not reversible, there is no actually, generally speaking, notion of invariant. People, I say, even use it informally in language, but I think it's really confusing. As I explained, you can, map any group to unit to any other group. It doesn't give you anything. There is no much sense in saying that you preserved something. In the sense that it just forgets fully that group and doesn't reflect the other group. And so the idea is to take rather transformation as rather than looking for invariance in transformation, which in that case should be all reversible, rather take all transformations, including non-reversible, and that is actually important, because if you just take only isomorphism, you cannot say also much about your structure. But if you take all transformations, right, like in a sense you consider all functions, is taking example of sets, right? You can say important things about sets. And actually that was first kind of foundational results about set theory, which was achieved by William Lovier in 63, that he proposed a way to say to do set theory, to describe what sets are, with categorical means, just by describing what kind of maps sets allows for, yeah? How maps in this case are functions, so how they compose, and so on and so far. And by these means, he achieved a description which he proved to be equivalent in, you know, appropriate sense with the usual Zermelo-Frankel description.
May I ask that, would it be right to say, correct to say that, in contrast to the old mathematics which set the point as the building element, the category theory put the relation consequently as the building element, so to say the empty relation without things being related, just the pure relation.
No, say that was very much motivation, say of Hilbert, in a sense, right? But for think about relation, you need a relata. How you think about
not
relation
really.
Without relata? In a sense, also that was also kind of thinking in category theory too. Then people say we don't need this material stuff. But no, just return to Hilbert. He said there are a system of things, right?
For instance,
and then relations. In a sense, only relations matter. That's true.
Yeah, for instance, in machine learning, we are not thinking about stuff being learned. We are simply thinking about the transformational mechanisms and about our engine, which is, so to say, setting up relations before they exist. But we can discuss this later.
Now, that was very much motivation, say, of at least of beginning from 20th century, that relations should be somehow at the first place. But then you still need, at least if you need any technical notion, I don't know, if you may suggest this notion of relations without relata, you can say you can just substitute your relata, whatever, as you put it, right? But then you need somehow describe these empty places. And what at least mathematicians did, they used set theory. Then, of course, they did how to do set theory itself. And actually what became a standard solution, which is very controversial, that Hilbert, for example, never by himself, was to use the same method to, it's very circular actually, to describe set theory itself. Because in set theory, again, we have basic relation that we call the epsilon, just membership, and we have two things, which we call sets or however, it doesn't matter, and it's all relational. Then we say, okay, for sets, we can again think whatever we want. It turns to be non-categorical, it's what known to be a squalling paradox. We can interpret all set theory with all high infinities with actually a very simple infinity. We can have countable model of whatever.
No, that's not true. But anyway. No. There's a petitio principii, but we can discuss it.
Okay, but I think all that development put relations in the first place still didn't work without it. What gave rise in certain sense, in my understanding, to set theory. Now with morphism, right, with category theory, many people also they say, okay, transformation is something like relations, right? And here we really get rid with. Can you also point nice things about points, that's this notion of point in category theory. And so in a sense, we describe pure relations without relata, without anything material. But I don't think that's correct, because transformation is not really a relation. At least if we give, if we're not speaking, you know, in all philosophical generality and vagueness, but trying to do some more precise and technical sense, what relation means, what morphism, transform map means, then they're not the same. Very obviously, for example, relation, something, two things are related or not related. They stand, the relation, say, between two given relata holds or does not hold, right? That's how things at least work on all formal presentation. And map is not like that. Map, if you want, is a particular object, right? We have a map like that, F. And it's not that it exists and doesn't exist, it's one question, but there may exist many maps in the same direction, many. So in a sense, map is more traditional mathematical object. Of course, it's kind of dialectically and historically connects to the notion of relation. But if you look a little bit at details, it's not relation. Actually, if you want to describe category theory through this language to relation, you may obtain rather straightforward axiomatization. It was done by Lavier, also very early, kind of axioms for category theory in standard setting. And then you need three place relations for composition. Then you need two place relation for domain and two place relation for codomain. Right? You don't need objects, of course, in that setting. You just say you have only morphisms. But that's, in my view, it's less interesting because that's just mean we use this old setting to describe what is category theory is, right? And if, as I want to find something really new here, so try to do that a bit differently. So, okay, here I just try to do very quick at some very elementary notions that we can introduce in this setting in category theory. For example, notion of product, say like Cartesian product of two sets, again. And here there is very important notion which calls universal property in category theory. So basically we have sets A and B, or they could be also structural sets. So we define these things which would work, say, for topological spaces, like product of topological spaces, or for groups, or whatever structural sets, and more, which is more interesting. So the idea is to find an object here. So we have two maps, actually, the injective map, surjective maps, which are projections, right? From product, product of sets is a set of pairs, of all ordered pairs, one member from one set, another member from the other set, right? And so we have these projectors, but then we say we require the following. We might have another object, again with a pair of map here and here, right? Whatever. And now we want that there is a single unique map on our product. Yeah. And that what in case of set would correspond to usual notion of product, or any case of structured set like topological space or whatever to correspond to usual notion, but it may also be conceived say independently in that abstract. Actually, also this topic of abstractness of category theory, in my sense, is kind of relational, if you want, because if you really think about categories more or less as I suggested, actually through all this background of structural mathematics, then you say, yeah, look, it's something huge and very, very abstract, very weak. But if, on the other hand, you just start to do your mathematics with your little arrows, it's rather simple setting, so rather straightforward definition, nothing abstract, it's very concrete, right? And presented with pictures, with diagrams. Yeah. But then the question is whether we can reconstruct from this elementary setting some more mathematically interesting things. And actually, as I already mentioned, it works. And also it allows for constructing new concepts which were never constructed in the usual setting. Maybe I said a couple of words if I have time. Okay, maybe the general limits I skip. That's a very simple notion, terminal object. Terminal object, we just require there is a distinguish object in our category such that there is exactly one map from any other object to this. Okay? Then we see that is defined up to unique isomorphism. That's rather straightforward, right? So I don't require it to be unique. I just give this definition. But if I have two of them, right? Here is one map here. Exactly one map here, since there is no other map there, isomorph, right? So up to unique isomorphism, and isomorphism is unique here. It's called canonical. So canonical isomorphism. So there, so up to isomorphism, there is a single terminal object. If it exists, it is unique up to isomorphism, right? In a, what is a terminal object in the category of sets? Can you imagine a set such as there is exactly one map from any other set to that set? Sets are just like build dots. Or think about finite sets. You know. Not generally, there are many, many maps. Yeah. Yes. But there is one case when there is just one map. Huh? Okay, maybe you are tired a little bit. But actually, that's easy because it's called singleton. If you have just set with one element, right? And set with one element is not an element itself, but one is kind of non-intuitive thing about set theory. So I show it in that way. Then from any other sets, and for any sets you should tell where every element is sent, right? I can leave just out something. And so you have no other choice but to send them there. So this map is determined. Right? Of course, you may say there are a lot of different singletons in the nature, right? But they will are not only isomorph, but there is unique isomorphism between any of them, right? So up to canonical isomorphism, it is unique thing. Yeah. Right? So it's terminal object, and similar things exist in certain categories, in certain others they don't exist. Now, having this notion of terminal object, we may define what does mean to be point. Yeah. And in set theory, say natural, if it's singleton, a natural notion of point or over element, right? It would be a map from terminal objects to something A. So every map is a point of this form, T, A. Okay, so that's definition which has this intuitive background. But now interesting thing for is an example what how say sort of non-trivial things we can say about. Now I would talk about sets, not going to further examples. What kind of non-trivial things we can say about sets on this say language of arrows? And one thing is that. That I would, so suppose I have a map from A to B, right? I have two different maps actually, F and G, okay? And here I have two points, one point in A and other points in B, okay? And then it may be the case that this triangle commutes. Yeah, that means that PA times F just give PB, okay? Then I would say that, and then it may be also the case that this triangle with G also commute. Okay? And then if it happens, then I say that our maps, F and G, they coincide on this pair of points, P and PB, okay? Now, if I define what this map is in this point-wise way, or element-wise way is in set theory, I see that my maps coincide if and only if they coincide on all their points. Hmm? But that's kind of a way to defining maps for sets, what set theoretic way, of course, because notion of function is much older, and that is rather late and actually controversial way to think about functions as this... element-wise correspondences, and of course that's that specific property of category of sets that two functions are equal if and only if they coincide with all their points, and generally doesn't hold at all. And okay, I will not really develop other examples, but kind of suggestive way, just take a set with the endo map. So I just take a set. With a map, that means that, say, I have a set, and then I have this map, I don't know, M, which just sends, say, this point to this point, for example, for this point, that point, for example, to itself, and that point, I don't know, here, for example, right? So that again, I have a point-wise, element-wise description of n the map. And then if you check this definition, what does mean to be point, you'll see that with now I form a category where my objects are not just bare sets, but sets with this and the maps, okay? And then you see that points in this sense are only fixed points, like this one, which are stable under this and the map, which is also rather intuitively suggestive, right? And of course, if you have now maps between these sets, they are not defined. They might not have stable points at all, yeah? So they might not have elements in that sense, right? So that condition, of course, that we can everything describe point-wise is something specific about sets. And if we are making category of even structured sets or even some more abstract categories, that wouldn't work, of course. Okay, that I skip exponential objects and just mention notion of functor. Functor is a map between different categories. Again, if you're starting thinking about kind of in the structural setting, it's rather complicated. But its principle is the same as homomorphism for group. But then you should really describe in which sense, if you look at the category as a structure, which is rather controversial because, as I mentioned, generally is not a set of object, but proper class. But if you somehow get around this difficulty, then you should describe how that structure, you know, fits the other structure. But principle is the same as for groups. There is nothing new. But actually, kind of next step in this categorical thinking is trying to think about maps as functors to begin with. That may be explained, I think, best by again analogy with set theory. Say, when we simply introduce notion of set, infinite set, right? Then we just talk about set of different things, like set of numbers, set of points, set whatnot. But if we want to make it into foundation mathematics, right? We say everything is set, which may be crazy, but that's the idea. We construct our numbers or points, everything out of sets, right? Similar with category theory. If you want to make category theory into foundational mathematics, we construct everything from categories. And in that setting, of course, there is no sense to distinguish, say, between morphism and functor. All our objects of a category are themselves categories. So we just start to work in that sort of setting. Okay. Okay. Now maybe there is other issues to discuss here, and then I'll say some words about topos theory because it's a really nice topic, without going to details. Yeah.
And if you can say a little bit about in set theory, the idea is that everything is made constructed out of sets, and with categories. It comes close to be something like a language or a scripture, which has very different implications. Like, what would be the characters? How would you derive? All the openness around language from that. But maybe it's too.
No, I think it's a very good point because, say, coming back to set theory, right? There exists set theory as specific and I would say rather isolated branch of mathematics, which is very much connected, say, to logic, like continuum hypothesis, things like this that people are working on. And of course, there is just fact that is widely applied as, say, a language. Mathematics is a way to construct mathematical objects and talk, which is rather different because it's not the same notion as set in a sense, or at least not straightforwardly. Right. With category theory, I think it is similar. There is people say working on pure category theory, and we have at least their critics saying, perhaps with not without reason, that there are little really non-trivial interesting problem really in pure category theory, right? But on the other hand, much more progress and much more evidence of, say, usefulness of a category theory just comes from the fact that it applied actually in many, many areas of mathematics and progressively becomes a rather usual language in mathematics, like in functional analysis, algebraic topologies all developed on with language category theory. Actually, one probably of most important events in not in pure category theory, but say in category theory just seen from wider mathematical context, was the fact that it was successfully applied for laying down, say, homology and cohomology theory. Because then it's really simplified thing and made things accessible for everybody who wants to learn it. And if you try to learn it without using categories, it's maybe not even now possible. Even people did this first before.
But is then language in that sense, would you describe that also as logical or formal calculus? Or is it language in a yet different
look, kind? Let me tell you, it's exactly what I'm going to say. It's a bit bears of that question, right? I think that it changes things, exactly. It suggests some change, even if there is no, how say, theorem that's in a sense, flexible matter. So, by introducing of this sort of categorical, purely categorical concept, you may actually specify, as I told you, you may specify what is category of sets. So in a sense, you may recover set theory through category theory, right? And you may also recover some other things. But one certain things you can recover, certain maybe are not recovered yet very well, it should be also mentioned. But perhaps more interesting, there are some new things invented, right? Not just recovering old stuff. And one of new important notions was the notion of topos, which, as I mentioned, had this double nature. It derives from geometry, but maybe I mentioned this so-called logical notion that came a bit later, again, the works of William Lavier, who actually again simplified this notion of topos, which was invented by Alexander Grothendieck in the early 70s, maybe late 60s. But William Lavier managed to generalize it a little bit, but also explain to rather simple construction of the thought that I had on my previous slide, right? So you may just require existence in your category of, say, certain properties, say, no, for example, like product, right? I say that as a product, but then, of course, the question whether it exists at circuit or not, right? And then you may kind of positive that it exists, but that's in a sense it's not interesting, right? It's more interesting just to have a more general context and prove that it exists. It's always a choice in mathematics. But say it exists in certain categories, does not exist in certain others. And for notion of topos, we just require more. And say again, an example of topos is a set. Category of set is a topos, right? But interesting thing that you can kind of weaken certain things about sets and still have a category which resembles category of set in many respects, but it's still not category of sets. And the interesting thing about that it allows for notion which now called internal logic. So in a sense, that the idea to look at a topos as a kind of logical framework, right? I'll explain how you first just think how you may about sets. You may think about sets in that way. I explain very, very, of course, intuitively. There is a sense in which classical propositional logic is an internal logic of topos of sets, right? And that's something which suggested by the use of what we call Venn diagrams. You know? So we have this perfect correspondence between set theoretic operations like union of two sets, right? Like taking complement of one set to another. Then we should always fix some set as a universe, right? And then look at subsets of these sets. Formally speaking, it's all about that logic of algebra of classical proposition as well as algebra of subsets of any given set is a full, complete Boolean lattice, complete Boolean algebra. Right, so there is a sense in which we may kind of associate classical logic directly with sets, right? Even if I would mention, if we draw that, we get some problems. For example, we don't know what to do with boundaries, right? So these pictures, in a sense, don't fit exactly. It works better if we just think about potatoes or something like that, right? And if you want to take boundaries into account, actually we get into Chianistic logic. That was already remarked by Tarski before, topos theory. Now, in a topos, which say I don't define now, but say category with a lot of same properties that we have in a set, how we define what is like subset, right? And here is definition. We define a notion of sub-object, which is actually we identify with any monomorphism. And I defined earlier what is monomorphism, with any injective map into this object. And then we may wonder what kind of structure of sub-objects of any given object we may have, okay? And then, for example, if we take that example of set with the Ender map, right? We see that it's still very generally, it's what called Heiting algebra. It's basically correspond to intuitionistic logic, right? But then, the further idea is somehow internalize logic even more and find truth values. Because in logic, okay, we have this algebra of proposition. I am not speaking now about logic of predicates. It's further issue. But we also have, to begin with, we have truth values, like true and false, right? And actually, we may think about this true and false as a set of two elements. And up to isomorphism, may identify all sets. So I said this set of two, the sets which I denote by two, right? And then we may find a construction, find a sense in which these two, that set of two elements, which we may call true and false, just classify all structure of our subsets, right? Basically, it means that if I have a set A and subset S, right? So about any elements here, I can say, yes, it is in this subset, and about any which is not, I can give a yes and no answer to the question whether a given element is in the subset or not, right? And I can express this answer through mapping properties, rather straightforwardly, right? But then if, I, for example, I take this example of set with the Ender map, then they are not classified in that way, right? So then, as truth value object, actually I have an infinite chain, like that, like natural numbers, more or less. Intuitively, it means the following. Here, for example, I take, for example, the singleton as subsets, right? And I'm asking, I take those three, right? And I'm asking whether this element is in this subset or not. And the answer is, it's not yet, but on the next step it will be there. So we have, this infinite number of truth values. But otherwise, the whole structure functions similarly, okay? That's logical notion of topos. But interestingly, that historically it came from geometry also, okay? And geometrical construction of topos was something like sheaves over topological space. Okay, maybe it's already everybody a bit tired, but it's kind of general, rather simple in a sense, generalization of what is topological space. Okay, and that's very interesting that Bill Levere discovered that advanced notion of topological space has these logical properties, has this intrinsic logic in it, you know, and the whole development of, then also Grothendieck invented that, here it's a shift over classical topological space, but actually he invented a notion of topology, which is also just in arrows. I may explain other time, yeah, very straightforward. How you, instead of speaking about open and closed sets, as classical general topologists do, you just define it in terms of arrows and also generalize. It's more general notion of topology than usual. Because it's not only about inclusion, but about all kinds of incoming maps. Very, very intuitive. Yeah, and so that knows why it's interesting, because you mentioned whether we bear on formalization, logic, and here maybe I just come to my last point before we discuss. So far I just spoke about these new ways of constructing objects, right? Basically, how we may construct new interesting mathematical objects with pure category theory, and how we may recover what we already knew with category theory, right? Or clarify some ideas which were too cumbersome with category theory. But big question for myself, whether we also, you remember when I spoke about the structural mathematics, I started with the structuralist notion of theory, and only then I came to this more specific structuralist notion, say, of object or structure, right? And the big question is whether category theory also bears on, say, theory building, whether we may have a new, hopefully better idea of building theories. And here I just want to mention two, say, existing approach, and then probably in discussion I may more say what I myself think about this. And existing approach are the following. First approach is, say, people say, why we use, say, sets, right? And the use of sets also comes with some use of specific logic, because something that I didn't mention, but this structuralist approach actually gives much more importance to logic than was before. Because if we say, okay, this intuition doesn't work, we are purely conceptual, we are free to lay out whatever axioms as we want, because our axioms are basically definitions, right? We are constructing worlds, we are not trying to, you know, to describe something that is there. But then we need some kind of basic rule, foundation. And what would be foundation? Logic, right? We need some basic logic to lay out different theories. And in a sense, then, of course, people in the 20s, 30s developed many, many different logics, without actually good idea how they relate to each other and which is really true logic. And basically it's situation, if we make this analogy of geometry, right, I still think that as far as logic is concerned, we are still in kind of Euclidean epoch, right? Because the problem is not only to become kind of skeptical, we say, okay, we take whatever logic as we want, but then we face problem of objectivity, what is right, or why we take one rather than the other, and so on and so forth. So with topuses, we say, okay, just take a topos and use its internal logic for building your theory, right? And that is a bit more than just take some arbitrary logic, right? Because your topos may correspond, say, to your situation that you try to describe with your theory. Say, there are works by Chris Isham in Oxford who are trying to develop quantum mechanics in a topos which, describes this quantum world, so to speak. Yeah. So that's one approach, rather traditional in a sense, rather than using kind of predefined logic, rather derive this logic from some topos, which also comes with certain geometrical properties. That's also interesting, right? So you have some kind of space-like notions also behind. That one thing, but a bit speculative. But another approach, which may be a bit more relevant to maybe to architecture, is appalling. Actually, again, Lavier, he tried to kind of mimic this traditional approach. He attended Tarski seminar, actually. And so he invented, also in his dissertation, what he called functorial semantics. The idea is this, that you present your theory as a, you may think that you have a topos, you have an, its internal logic, and you just lay out your axioms in that internal logic, right? But then you just look at functors from your theory to category of sets, right? And every functor would be model, is in rather straightforward Tarski sense, it's a theoretical model of your theory. But then, of course, what you immediately discover that it's not categorical, right? Generally, as I already mentioned. But then, in a sense, it's not a problem. What you really want, then you consider the category of those functors. Yeah? And what you want really, that your category of your models have, say, some nice properties. Then there is very general, it's called Yona dilemma, on very, I would say, general condition, you may actually embed your theory to your category of models. So in a sense, it just becomes one of models. But one of models, which is special. And what is special about that? It's special that it's kind of generating models, right? Yeah, there is one model, which with this, again, saturated background in that case, just generate all other models. So that's really, for me, sounds like interesting changing of ideas. In a sense, I say Euclid strikes back, because it's actually a very old idea, right, that in mathematics you are not just some truth, you're not taking just some truths as axioms and trying to derive something, but you have some constructive principle. So, say, in Euclid, you have two generic figures, circle and line, and in a sense, all Euclidean universe is constructed out of that. Right. So here is something similar. You have your theory as a as something that generates all the rest, but you no longer look that this the rest is unique up to isomorphism somehow. Doesn't make any longer sense. Right? What you need that is kind of manageable category that you can describe properties and being stuff. And similar approach actually was developed, but very independently and with very different ideological background, was developed in France by Charles Erisman and his pupils. It's called sketch theory. And the idea is similar, except here is nobody would think about anything logical about that, right? That would say, okay, let's just take some small category, just find it in a diagram which I can just draw like that and look its functors best category of sets. They didn't look other categories, even they mentioned we may take whatever topos instead of sets, it would be the same. Yeah, and here, for example, this is a sketch for directed graphs. Directed graphs is like category instead of there is no composition, right? It's a graph with arrows. So you have set of arrows, you have a set of nodes, and you have a map that prescribes to every arrow its source and a map that prescribes its target. Then you just look at category of functors of this thing to sets. It'll be again a topos, a sexual general result. If you have a small category and look of all functors from that category to sets, then those category of those functors is again a topos. All right. And so you have all graphs, and after all, you can embed these things in your graphs, right? And then it's also, for example, you might not want to call every functor a model, right? You might just specify your notion of model. And say ideologically, I try to make a model. I think, why is it interesting? Because all this thinking, structuralist thinking, was, okay, we just somehow distinguish with invariant, and then we just leave the stuff how it's projected, how it's represented. It's somehow automatic. Here with category theory, we are thinking about these representations, right? So we may just really study how whatever we want to call the structure, theory, whatever, how it's really projected, how many times, and in which way, and so long, so far. For example, just to give example, for example, Hilbert would say, okay, I just take pair of real numbers to be a point, and then I just apply very usual arithmetic, so I have an arithmetical model of geometry, right? With category theory, we could imagine we have somehow categorically presented this theory of geometry, right? Theory of arithmetic, and then there are functors. There are ways to represent this geometry in arithmetics. But then we may also so ask how many functors, you know, how they're going. And in a sense, all this ideology that we go formal, I think it doesn't work any longer. Because in a sense, if we have, say, if we map A to B, we cannot forget about A, neither about A, neither about B. You know?
Did you say does or does not? Does not work any longer.
Yeah, does not work any longer, I think, yeah. Yeah, so... Yeah, when you mentioned that problem of how say how we use a computer in architecture, I don't know anything about. But what I could think of would be interesting. That could be modeled is not just that we make some image on Photoshop or whatever, and then we say okay we want to be a building, right? But we may also think how say image or whatever theoretical construct or model. Right, how it may map to, say, environment, to material conditions, and somehow model these things too, and that's in my view. In a sense, I say it's traditional idea. We just come back to you. Okay. Yeah, here is some literature which actually rather full list. You may go to. This article of Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, there is category theory entry, and there is rather rich literature there. That's very, very, the only actually elementary introduction, which is a bit biased in the sense it's all about category, not only even by set, but of finite sets. It's all about dots and maps and exercises, but that's very, very good. Yeah, that's about, actually comes to toposes, but say without geometry. That's a really good book. And there are not all, but I would say rather hard.
I have a question. What about continuous transformations between categories?
Continuous.
Because categories are somehow distinct, discrete objects. Do I understand it right?
No, I mean, it just depends of your what you mean by continuous transformation. One thing you may mean, right? You may want, for example, to describe what is category of topological spaces. You know, there are also this double thinking category theory. Because in one sense, right, you imagine your objects and transformations somehow given by Bourbaki, something like that, right, by the structure. So you know what is topological space is, you know what is continuous transformation in that standard definition, and you make this stuff into a category, and then you may look for some properties of that category and just use it for whatever reason you want. That's one thing. Another kind of more radical, you say, okay, I somehow take whatever abstract category like that, right, and I want to specify in that way that it would be like, you know, and very much like category of topological spaces. And that's also, it's worked somehow dialectically, because actually that case, okay, let me mention different case about Riemannian spaces, which is, you know, was also very differential manifolds. And that was very interesting, because then people try to just take usual definition of what is differential manifold, put it in a category, and then you see it doesn't work very well. And then, but then you see how to modify it a little bit that it would work well, and that suggested really some new ideas about differential manifold That's really interesting.
Even more radical, I think.
Yeah, about topological space. No, say the mainstream development, of course, through notion of topos, because as I mentioned, then you define you may start, as I mentioned, just from usual notion of sheaf or a topological space. Okay, so you have topological space. Then you try to describe what topology is, purely categorical with errors. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then Grothendieck did this and even did better than that in the sense that he invented generalized notion of topology.
I didn't mention that, okay, topological transformations are continuous, but the notion of a category of topological transformation makes, again, a discrete thing of it.
But actually, topology is also about discrete things. In a sense, topology is just shows you what is discrete, what's continuous. Just all this monodromy, think about this kind of thing. Just through topology, we can really understand what does mean to be discrete, right? So, in a sense,
and I thought that okay, we have in group theory we have these symmetries and the permutations of the symmetries, which we then call a group, discrete groups. And we have these continuous transformations, which are a little bit more complicated, but which are also introducing some very different ideas. I'm just taking now this move, like what to resolve this arrow. So to say, this arrow is a discrete entity somehow. And now to get rid of these arrows. More like a potential, not drawing this arrow, and even not drawing the finite sets of Lavier, of course. So, but even both things more open.
Mm. Now, say Lie group, I think categorically speaking, continuous group, Lie groups. It's not just pure groups in a sense, right? In a sense, it's a group with additional structure. Mm-hmm. So if in a sense, it perhaps is better analyzed exactly as a factor, say from groups to topological spaces,
okay.
Or something like that. But I don't know. No, there is a notion of, say, geometrical map of topos, because say if you have topos, since there are these two different aspects of topos, you may either require so-called to preserve this logical structure in the topos, right? And you have actually more complicated notion of geometrical morphism of topos. Yeah. So,
another question would be, the last part was a little bit confusing for me.
Yeah, it was kind of...
but probably that's not due to your presentation. It is somehow self-referential at a point. Suddenly, the things defined as a category are reintroduced at a lower level. Am I right? There's a trace of self-referentiality. No?
Yeah, but that's all business about foundations like that. It resets as well, right?
But then, if we are going self-referential, we are losing ground. So say, we are flying around, and that of course then gets somehow generative.
Mm.
But it gets not generative in a particular direction. You have to choose it. So to say, introducing this kind of...
I see. No, first remark, that this set theory is exactly the same thing. Because if we are developing this Hilbert setting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we're trying to be more precise about what we mean by theory, by model, and so on and so forth, right? Then we... when I say weeds, what really happened in history, so I'm not trying to invent alternative histories. So we need this notion of set there, right? Just to serve as kind of relative relation that you want. Then sets is something that leads you to paradoxes. It's not as clear and easy as one might wish. Then what people try to do? Use the same structuralist method to describe what sets are. And that's what what gave Zermelo-Fraenkel axiomatics. Yeah. Of course, it's absolutely circular. We say you have this Zermelo-Fraenkel theory, and you need to interpret it somewhere. Where you interpret it, and then when people working, you know, like in model theory and continuum hypothesis, they say, okay, we have another copy of that and interpret it in itself and stuff like that. So in a sense, I think it's every this foundational project doomed to be circular. Then I'm not very, how to say, myself clear stance about is it good idea or not, say, making foundation of category theory, in which sense foundations, because in a sense I think it's, mathematically speaking, of course it's crazy, and I'm sure it wouldn't work. You just say everything is category. Just like saying everything is set never really worked, and mathematics make fun of that. But in a sense, it was productive, right? And so I think this crazy philosophical extreme ideas, even though when there are real good practitioners who, you know, take it with a pinch of salt, I think then everything is okay, and we may try to push it as far as, you know.
What I loved quite a lot
pushed.
What I loved quite a lot was that first, so to say, in the case of the topos, that first there is a practical problem, and like in the quantum topos, as I understood.
No, historically, that, no.
Not historically, practically, in your last slide, with this, how was his name? Ishman.
Isham, yeah, Christ Isham.
Okay, there you said, okay, that the logic, that the logics, a particular logics developed inside a particular topos.
Yeah.
First we have the topos and then we have the logics.
Yeah, that's what he tries to do, yeah.
Okay.
He tries to do.
And have you some examples? What kind of logics there springs out?
No, actually it's less weird than so-called quantum logic. That's actually was his point. Because so-called quantum logic is not really, I mean, arguably is not logic at all, right? It's kind of, it's orthomodal or lattice, right? But why call it logic? It's rather questionable. In a topos, in a sense, it always intuitionistic, right? That's everything. Of course, then you may try to modify your notion of topos as well. But if you're just talking about topos in usual sense, it's always intuitionistic. Albeit the truth value object, it's not classical, right? It's, say, if we take sheaf over usual topological space or over a site, site is a topological space in this generalized Grothendieck sense, then that very site or topological space serves as a truth value object.
Okay.
So in a sense, it's more usual. It's closer to something like logic there. But that's rather, I've never seen this approach really worked out. He made this suggestion actually a time ago. Now he's a younger guy, Andreas Döring, who pushes the thing further. But perhaps it's just too much foundational. Physicists are not very much interested in that because usually they're less interested in foundations than application. I don't know. No, I think that perhaps the second approach, in a sense, that it may, they may converge those two approaches, because not necessarily through notion of topos, because also many people say, okay, topos is just too restrictive, why we should only think about topos. But generally the idea that you may, somehow adopt your logic first to your some geometrical properties, and that logical properties should come together with geometrical properties, and not just from heavens. I think that's a very interesting idea.
Any quite other question?
Sorry.
How big is the community working on these things?
No, I think, I never...
Hundreds, thousands?
No, a lot of people on computer say, some mathematicians generally a bit suspicious about, say, pure category theory for rather clear reasons, as I say, that there are problems in pure category theory, in pure topos theory, but sometimes they are maybe too specific. But otherwise, just category theory is used, and that is really popular. But people specifically work in category theory. There is this mailing list category theory, so there is a journal. It's still quite established business.
What does it mean? How many people, researchers, are working on that? Using categories and really trying to bring it further. How many researchers are working in this field?
A few hundreds, that's certain.
They're working on in pushing it further.
Yeah, many people in computer science department. Also, they may be more concerned with applications, but.
But this is an application of category, of category theory.
Yeah.
This is with computer science. They are in the applications of these kind of theories. Yeah, the computer science people. Or are they pushing the theory itself?
Now, some of them, I think, but in fields like that, I think some things are, I'll say, are advanced through some interesting applications. And these people who somehow think about this, I'll say, from this foundational viewpoint, that's more rare, of course. Yeah, that's rather Levere and his pupils.
And this foundation, how many people are there?
No, but still, if you say last year in France, there was a rather big conference. But I think if I say generally category theory, I say 1,000, I think it's
true. It would be true.
Can I have some very different question again? When you say Euclid strikes back, or that we are back to the problem of how to conceive of objects in a logical way, as a logical system. What exactly does that involve, philosophically speaking?
Yeah, thank you. Actually, I just put it. I didn't develop. I think in geometry, what I've all this so-called revolutions in geometry. For me, actually, it happened with Gauss, rather than other people, which were later. And I think a great idea of Gauss was what he called intrinsic geometry, right? That if we he actually discovered it through practical work from, surveying, around Hanover, he had to make maps, right? And so, obviously, it's not Euclidean there because you have hills and stuff, but still differentiable because hills are more or less smooth. Right. So that's kind of admittable generalization. Yeah, and so what is important, because that maybe I modernize it, but at least Riemann certainly understood in that way that there are actually two things here, right? You may look on this surface as surface embedded in Euclidean space, right? Or you make put yourself on the surface, right? Imagine yourself, an ant living on the surface and thinking about this surface as a space of its own, right? And now, basically, in terms of this notion of category, that would mean, of course, that what we study actually maps, right? We map, we embed. Embedding is a map, is an injective map, right? We study how this surface is embedded, in Euclidean space. Not all surfaces are embeddable. Some other, like Klein bottle, is embeddable, but with self-intersection, stuff like this. So there is a lot of geometrical properties to be studied. And then we also study how some other things, what it does mean. Because some people in early category theory would claim that category theory is kind of black box mathematics. So instead of thinking, about structures in terms of the elements, right, we rather study their maps, or we take them as a black box and study their, their effects. But I think, and Bill Levere disagrees with that, and I agree with Bill Levere, that's not true, because actually when we study maps inside something, right, inside in just incoming maps. That actually gives us information about what is inside there, right? Because everything that we kind of think as an element, what is it, like in a point, an element of a set even in this setting, would be just a incoming map from terminal object there, right? We can also study maps of different shapes. That is the simplest shape, like it being a point, right? But we can say how we can embed a line and so on and so forth. So in a sense, that suggests this relational thinking. We can, about this distinction between being a space and being an object in a space, right? Which is, for example, fundamental for Newton and Kant, and not so much for ancients, because notion of space actually doesn't exist there. But now it's relativized, right? So every, to be an object just means to be mapped into some other objects, right? So we can look at every object as a space and then every space as an object. Now, with logic, I think all this development of, you know, non-standard logic, whatever, we very much learn to think about logic as objects, right? We present them as formal calculi, we study their mathematical properties, so we objectify logics. But now it's what may be interesting and what may come through topos theory, just to think about certain object as a system of law, not about every, maybe not every object just allows to anything like internal logic, but certain objects are, and that would, and then that would allow for similar relativism about logic, which I think would be very, very productive. But I would like to understand if there is some possible relevance to this stuff, to just to this. Because I'm personally rather concerned with kind of philosophical issues about that, different,
you know,
ways that...
In machine learning, we have the same foundational problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because somehow the story has to start. And we cannot program that start, so we have to understand how to provide the properties of the embedding space such that it starts understanding of itself and are becoming able to learn or becoming able to do mappings at all.
Mm-hmm.
So how to define that without defining that in a pre-specific way?
Actually, just a point to your remark about formalization. I also think what it changes somehow ideologically in an interesting way, that the idea behind, say, writing, developing formal languages was kind of standardization, right? You define standard presentation for like in Hilbert, right? We, instead of thinking crazy things about geometry, we just put string of symbols were very clear. So some kind of standard, and then of course we say, okay, we translate it in different way, whatever. And here on the other hand, we just basic thing becomes translation itself, right?
Yeah.
So in a sense, we rather than trying to find, you know, standard language and something, we just find kind of, I would like to say structure of translations, because in my sense, it's not structure, it's a category. It's a category, in my sense, is something that may replace notion of structure.
Because it would be a notion of translation ability without having something like an Ur language to which it refers, or without having the original frame of reference to derive it from. So it would be become itself through this translation.
Right. But then, of course, if you ask anything goes or not, you say still not, because you have, at least in this setting, you have very precise rules, say, about translations, about what works, what does work. It also, I don't know, it would be interesting, for example, apply just a question of translation, because people usually say, okay, that's usual translations also are not reversible, right? So you might imagine something like terminal language, for example, artificial language, a kind of language where you can translate everything in a unique way. That would be Maybe very and then initial language, which is dual, and initial would mean in any language you would translate, and that was not at all the same, right? And they may serve for very different purposes.
But in many ways, this, I mean, with the ancients, now, a lot was starting to get more orderly describable because of this interplay between geometrical, systematical, deductive thinking, the writing in words, in fixing statements, and kind of analytical relation between these three poles, and they were very different. I would say medialities.
Which poles?
Geometrical figures, arithmetics, thinking about relations, and language in written words as the way to describe what is going on. There's an interplay between these three for all of the ancients.
Yeah,
and that's very constitutive for all of our tradition of science and philosophy.
Yeah.
And what is so interesting right now from our side, more in the computer programs as they proceed, and but also in what you are describing in mathematics, is that these separated maybe dimensions or whatever of constituting reflective ways of reasoning, they somehow conflate in a self-referential,
mm-hmm.
non-separable way now. And this is, I think it's a very crucial event historically that is, I wouldn't know really what to compare it to.
Well, but as you say yourself, there was always kind of interplay of different...
Exactly, but this interplay is becoming conflated into not three I don't know how to call it, self-referential build referring on different scales to themselves. They get the relation changes a lot.
Mm-hmm. I also am trying to find in this category is through kind of intuitive background, so in a sense, for me, all those movements, say, of 20th century, just all to go symbolic. But then, of course, what does it mean to be symbolic, right? And practically, that would mean something like, you know, this alphabetic writing. And theoretically, that would mean as I read in Kassirer, for example, that somehow material does matter, right? He Kassirer, for among other things, he was really very impressed by example. And actually, I met such person in my life as well, who was born blind and deaf and everything, so could only tactile perception, and still developed perfect. And when I contacted, you know, communicate with such a person, actually, my expression was that it's kind of banal, that it's normal person. I mean, you expect something special, and finally, and actually, it makes him how many things that we tell, we just kind of mimicking, we just repeating. So, and the Kassirer also describes similar example, and then conclusion he makes is that actually it doesn't matter how you make kind of this tactile language or written language or whatever, it doesn't matter at all. What does it mean? It's, you know, it's kind of coding and others, all this perception, intuition. And in a sense, I think it's just still, however impressive are such examples, it's still too stochastic conclusion in my sense, because... See, one, I think, important failure of this, you know, structural thinking is physics, natural science, because it never made it into natural science. But all this, what Hilbert put as sixth problem, right, just axiomatized physics in more or less the same way he did with mathematics, never worked, and not even, I think, because, how say, it was somehow very difficult to do, but just physicists were not interested and are not interested in that. And so it's not really they really do need some link to perception, to real experiment, to real observation, and I think that is fundamental. And so all this idea, because I tried really to trace where people decided that, you know, the intuition doesn't work any longer, and I really didn't find really, an argument. Just people keep saying Kant was wrong, it doesn't work any longer, mathematics changed so much that it's, we should do something absolutely else. And I still think that however mathematics, actually my big picture is something like this, that we have a period when, so to speak, intuition goes ahead of concept, right? Basically that means that, say, even imagining kind of Euclidean setting, right? We can, I don't know, draw a curved line, right? Or even they had kind of complicated mechanical lines that they couldn't transcend, what we call today transcendental, that we couldn't describe mathematically, right? And then, of course, there was a big progress in 17th century of understanding all these curves and then surfaces with Gauss and so forth. But there are other cases, and also not only recently, but also, say, also in 17th century, when, so to speak, conceptual development works goes ahead. And then the task is somehow to bring good intuitions, to invent good intuitions. One maybe is not very convincing, but one may interpret the old story of complex numbers as saying that when Gauss invented geometrical interpretation of complex numbers, that was really important step. Yeah, then people say, they are real things. But even if we're not concerned about ontological, you know, problem, that they're real or not, but that's really that gave, important impulse in mathematical development, complex geometry.
So, your life world,
uh-huh,
of categories is forming some kind of a space.
What?
It's your system or your thinking,
mm-hmm,
because you will obviously develop some kind of intuition. That means you can decide about similar things, about things which,
yeah,
are related to each other. In some way you have constructed a kind of space, rather abstract. Would you?
No, I think what is interesting, what some people are trying to do, just say any category is something like space. I think it's not so interesting saying that. That's true, that there is some intuitive thinking, I think, even when we draw diagrams, then of course it also can be studied. Actually, diagrams can be made into a category, so we can also study what is a diagram also
categorically,
right?
I mean,
right.
Abstract.
And then, of course, I think it's important that we can represent this with arrows and stuff. But then, more interesting question, I think, we can ask what sort of category can be reasonably called a space,
mm-hmm,
right? What we need in a category to be space. Then, in a sense, it's a definition. We can define. Well, but then it's interesting. What is good concept of space? And there are some suggestions. I think Bill Weaver's say something like Grothendieck. I'm not prepared now to give an answer to this question, but I think it's a reasonable question. What kind of category makes a space? What kind of category would be appropriately called algebraic?
Or the other way around, which space do we need to embed the categories?
No, I don't mean embed categories, because that I don't understand.
If we, it's not a geometrical space, of course, and we would have to discuss the properties of that space. But if we talk, and obviously we talk about different kinds of categories, we are implicitly forming a space where all the categories are somehow in.
I think that assumption is wrong. It was exactly assumption which we find in Kant, right? And Kant actually used it for good reason, because Kant relied more or less on Newton's Principia as a good example of doing science. And for his time, that was, I think, indisputably the best successful science, right? So he, and then I think important challenge for post-Kantian philosophy, for anybody who wants, you know, continues his line in some way, it's not just change your idea about space, right? Euclidean, non-Euclidean, but exactly to somehow give up that assumption that we just have just a single space as a, you know, a priori form of intuition. Of even what I just tried to explain with Gauss, with this relativization of notion of space object and intrinsic geometry, it's completely intuitive in my sense, but still it's there is no this notion of ambient space, and even in projective geometry in a sense it's all plain.
I do not mention that space,
but whatever, frankly I don't see this idea that we have just one big space for everything.
No, not one big space.
I don't think
let me go discuss it afterwards.
Yes, I think
with some wine or so.
I think.
Thank you very much.
This great lecture. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.